This is 4:55 on Wednesday, September 4th. All right, good morning. Welcome back. Hope everybody had a good break, holiday, whatever. Didn't work too hard. Any questions before we start? So our TA is looking at the assignments that you turned in, and my intention is to have him return them via Angel, but I've never done that before, so we'll see how it works. And if for some reason that doesn't work out well, we'll switch to doing it by email. So, but one way or another, I'll let you know where to find the feedback on those. So remember, those are being graded as sort of plus check, minus grading on each of the problems to indicate got it, almost got it, or sort of missed the boat, because they don't count a whole lot, so I don't want to put too much store in lots of different numbers of points. Okay, I think with that then we're ready to roll on. We're in the midst of talking about HTTP, and you'll recall that we said last time that HTTP as a protocol was stateless, but the problem that poses is that there are lots of interesting applications for web technology where state shared between the client and the server is important, and if you have a stateless protocol, what do you do about that? So that's what we start with today, and the technology that's built into HTTP to support that is called cookies. And you've heard of cookies, right? And you've heard bad things about cookies and how people misuse cookies and so forth. But cookies, why cookies? Why the term cookie? Well, I think it goes back to the sort of folklore magic cookie meme that may have existed before this, you know, and sort of if you give a mouse a cookie and all that stuff. But a magic cookie is something that you give to somebody that when they present it somewhere else, it will cause something magical to happen. And so I think that's where the term cookie comes from. What is a cookie? Well, it's just a little bit of data, or a little or a lot of data, and it's data that's sent in a header line of HTTP response messages that just says, you know, the header name is cookie, essentially, and there's this data associated with that header. And the deal is that when a browser receives a cookie like that, then the next time it makes an HTTP request to that same server, it returns that data to the server in a request cookie header line. And I say the next time, I mean it persists until for some reason the cookie goes away. And how do cookies go away? Well, there are two kinds of cookies, at least. There's the kind of cookie that the server says just keep it in the browser memory, the active memory of the browser, as long as the browser is running, and keep sending it back to me like so. Or you can have what's called persistent cookies that get stored in files, and persistent cookies keep getting sent to the browser until they're cleared. So you know, this seems like a very simple bit of mechanism. It's just some data that's sent from the client, from the server to the client. The client sends it back. But of course, the trick to making it work is that the browser keeps state. Sorry, the server keeps state in, say, a database or in the server's memory that allows it to look up the data that comes back from the client and associate it with whatever's happened previously with that client. So cookies are used to implement shopping carts. They're used to implement sort of persistent authentication. If you use Google services now, they have what's called two-factor authentication associated with Google services, where you get a code that comes over your phone or from an app or from a piece of paper or something, and you can enter it into a browser. And if you come back to Google using that same browser later, you don't have to re-authenticate. Why? Because they've stored a cookie in your browser that the browser sends and says, okay, we've done authentication. This is a computer that belongs to that person and so forth. Okay? So cookies can be abused. The kinds of tricks that people play is they get you to visit, they send you a link to something that's on a different site. That site gives you a cookie, and when you come back to the first site, the other site's cookie gets sent to the other site, and they know what you're doing. You know, it's very abusable, but it's also very simple. So, pictorially, the client makes a request. I don't know what eBay has to do with this. What does eBay have to do with this? Oh, I see. This was the client's previous cookie state, and now we've contacted Amazon, and it's come back with a set cookie header, and we remember that. And next time we make a request, and so on and so forth, so that Amazon knows that this request came from the same place that this one. Yeah.
In an unsimplified version, would there be a little bit more than just a number? Because otherwise, would you get?
Right. There's actually a name and a number for each cookie, and so you can clear a cookie associated with a name.
Yeah.
If you go into, let's see, this is probably worth looking at. Why is that? Let's see if I can remember how to negotiate this thing. Yeah. Go here and you go to options. Where did they put it? Never remember where this is in this one. Where are settings? Under edit. Well,
I think it's under options, I think.
You just click on options. It's not at all clear. And then, let's see, is it under content, general, no, privacy, security.
No, under privacy there was a...
There was a cookies.
Under Firefox will remember history, there's two links, clear recent history or...
Yeah, okay. But there's also a way to see your cookies, like so. And different browsers have different ways of doing this, and even on different operating systems, they're different. So it's kind of scary. I don't know if you can see down here. So you see the name of the cookie and the content of the cookie and when it expires. 20 years from now, or 10 years from now. 10 years. You know, that's kind of ridiculous. But I don't think I'll still have this browser state 10 years from now.
And then is it possible for them to update cookies, I suppose?
You bet. If they resend this same cookie name with a different content, then they'll just be that latest one there. So, as I said, if the cookies are stored on disk, they're persistent cookies, and you can come back. If they're ephemeral cookies, they disappear when the browser exits. In fact, the click system uses cookies it uses ephemeral cookies, ones that only last through the browser state, to remember who you are after you log in. And it passes back a cookie each time you submit an answer, so that what I see it for answers actually has names associated with them. So the state is not part of the protocol. It's just maintained at either end and associated by way of the cookies that are carried in the HTTP. Next thing about web. Caching and web caches, also known as proxy servers. So the idea here is to somehow answer a client's request for a web page without having to go all the way to the origin server to get it. And the term that's used is proxy server as well as a web cache. Why proxy server? Because the proxy server acts both as a server, in that it produces HTTP responses, and as a client, in that it makes HTTP requests. It's a cache in the sense that a subsequent request for the same page can be served out of the storage that's maintained here. What are we doing with that? So why? Number of reasons. The proxying thing and the caching thing are really two separate notions. The proxying can be used, for example, to implement filters on which websites can be reached from a particular network, because the proxy server actually gets to see that request that comes in and say, is this one that I want to pass through or not? And if not, it can reject it. The caching is to improve the network performance. And we have an example of that. So this is a little bit artificial, but it will do. So suppose that the average HTTP object size is 100,000 bits. We're going to do it in bits. 100,000 bits. So about 10K bytes. And that we have browsers making 15 requests per second from within inside this enterprise network, or institutional network. So if you do that, if you multiply that out, you get 1.5 megabits per second as the amount of web traffic coming back over this link. Now, 10 years ago, a 1.5 megabit per second link was a very expensive link already. And so that would be what an institution might have as its access to the public internet. But if you look at the parameters here, you see that our 10 megabit a second institutional network, I've got to fix something. if this is a 1 gigabit per second, LAN, then the LAN utilization is not 15%, right? It's 0.15%, which only makes the case stronger for what's going on here. But the utilization of this link is around 99%. All right. So remember now what that picture we drew about congestion delays, right? Remember this one? When the utilization nears 1, the congestion delays go to infinity. Utilization. So, what we're seeing in this situation is that the individual requests from the browsers are taking a long time because this link is really quite heavily loaded. So, let's update this to a more reasonable modern day configuration. Even today, 154 megabits per second is going to be a very expensive link to have for your institution. So we get the utilization down . The math on these slides is just terrible. It's just awful, right? This is approximately 1% utilization. Okay, 1% utilization. All right, so the result of that, you know, once we got it down even to 10%, the queuing delays would be minimal, and we'd only be suffering whatever the latency was out to that. And they've sort of chosen a outrageous number there as well. 2 seconds, probably 100 milliseconds would be a better number for that. But anyway, that's okay. So one way to fix this problem is to upgrade this link. But the other way is to create a local cache here within the institution, and let's see what happens then. What matters? So we still have the LAN utilization of being whatever it was, 1.5%, 0.15%. What would be the access link utilization in this configuration? Well, what would we have to know in order to figure that out? It's a cache, right? Well, yeah. How good is the cache? How many requests out of all the requests being made can be served from the cache versus have to be sent out over the wide area network? So, this is a classical computer systems engineering sort of question. Which you should be familiar with from Computer Science 260, maybe 360, and we'll do it again here, right? So how does it work? you determine what's called the hit rate, which is the number of the fraction of the requests satisfied from the cache . Okay, and so 40% of the requests are satisfied locally, 60% have to go out over the network. So the average data rate then is derived by multiplying how many? By the fraction of the traffic that actually has to go over the link, which is 0.6, times the 1.5 megabits per second, that was the traffic coming back to answer things, was 0.9 megabits per second, and that gets the utilization of that link down to about 58%. There is a decimal point there, 0.58. and the total delay calculation is, it's the average total delay now. Average total delay is 0.6 times the delay when you go out to get things, plus 0.4 times the local satisfaction rate, and you calculate that things have improved and that it's cheaper too. Okay? So this is important. Right? Because it's classical computer science stuff, and I think it's something you need to know how to do. Things to watch out for here. It's very sensitive, like any caching scheme, to the hit rate. So if the hit rate is low, this won't do you much good. And that's part of the problem these days with using local web caches, is that so much of the content that we get when we browse the web these days is pretty dynamic, that it's hard for institutions to develop local web caches that can have very high hit rates. So the other direction that things go is that, I don't know if there's, no, there's not. Back up. So the other thing that's happening out here is that there are companies that build caches that live sort of just at the edge of the public internet. And what they do is the servers, the people who build servers of this very dynamic content, like ESPN and CNN and others that have sort of large amounts of data that they want to get close to the customers, they actually push it out to these caching servers at the edge of the network. And so the traffic doesn't have to cross very much of the public internet before it can be served. But that's a different kind of caching than this one. This one is sort of demand driven, and this one is driven by people who want to lower their bills for data delivery from the other side. Yes?
So pretty much any website that uses cookies can't make use of web caches.
That's pretty much true. It depends on what they use them for, right? And this technology is very sophisticated in that regard. The local caching typically is not. So, you know, Amazon or any purchasing thing is not going to work very well with local web caches.
Although with something like that, the images that you load up, those could work.
The images could definitely be cached, sure. The objects themselves rather than the whole pages. So lots of opportunity to improve things. Another technique for reducing traffic is the so-called conditional get operation. Remember, get is one of the is one of the HTTP request things. One of the things you can put in the headers for a GET request is an if modified since and give a date and time. And then the server will look at the time stamp associated with the object you're asking for, and if it hasn't changed, it just returns a response, 304 not modified, which tells the client that it can use its own cached version. So client, this supports what's called client caching. So that's the other thing that happens, is that browsers typically do some amount of client caching as well as the proxy server based caching. So etc. Okay, any questions about web? At the end of the class, you guys are actually going to implement a proxy server. It won't do caching, but it will do proxying because that gives you lots of practice with both the client side and the server side of HTTP and the programming techniques associated with those. So, but we'll work our way up to that because there are several things that need to happen first. All right. The FTP protocol, file transfer protocol, is one of the classic protocols of the internet, one of the ones that it got started with, if you will, going back all the way to the late 1980s. I'm not going to talk about it very much because for modern day use, I strongly urge people not to use it. There are still web hosting providers who accept your uploads of your pages using FTP, but it's really not a very good idea. Let me show you why. It's a command and response protocol. It uses plain text ASCII, and the first thing you do when you contact a server is you say, I'm username, and here's my password. Okay? Over public connections, this is not great. You've just revealed your password. And for... And this was an early protocol, so people didn't have a lot of experience designing protocols like this at the time. So FTP actually uses, as it says here, separate control and data connections. You make a control connection where you issue commands, and it then sends the data back to you over a different TCP connection. It turns out this makes it very hard to use techniques like secure sockets or transport layer security to secure this protocol. So there are better ways of doing this, using what's called secure shell and secure copy, SCP, protocols that sort of don't involve this complication of two connections and all that stuff, and don't reveal passwords. So we're not going to say very much. This is all I'm going to say about FTP. It's a classic, but these days, don't do it. Electronic mail, on the other hand, is modern and current and all that. So, electronic mail, we all use it, but we probably don't all think very much about what happens when we do. How does it go? You compose your email in something like what? What are your favorite email programs? Gmail? Hotmail? Okay, you guys are all web-based mail users. That's fine. Those are called user agents. And a user agent typically has a sending part and a receiving part for creating mail and receiving mail. So you compose your mail, and you send it off to a mail server or a website, whatever, Gmail, Hotmail, and that server then interacts with other mail servers using this protocol called SMTP. It stands for Simple Mail Transfer Protocol. Okay, and this thing is actually, SMTP is actually designed so that mail can make many hops between the place where it's created and the place where it's ultimately going to be delivered. Now these days, I was going to say these days that's not necessary, but in fact, mail typically makes many hops before it gets to where it's going, and it gets where it gets to the mail server of the destination person, who then uses a user agent to retrieve it from the server. And when you use Gmail or Hotmail, the user agent is essentially JavaScript code that's running in your browser and interacting with a program that runs on the mail server to interact with your mailbox stuff. Okay? I tend to use Thunderbird a lot, which is a user agent that interacts essentially directly with mail servers by sending SMTP to them. So it serves directly. But you don't have to do it that way. Okay. So on the destination mail server, everybody has a mailbox that contains the incoming messages, and there's a global message queue of outgoing messages. The outgoing messages are sent by SMTP, and the incoming messages are retrieved by the user agent using a user agent protocol. So SMTP is another one of these ancient protocols of the internet. It's been around for a long time. You can sort of tell by the port numbers that they use. The lower the number, the earlier on it typically got defined. It uses plain ASCII, again, to transfer messages. It involves a handshake at the beginning, and then transfer of the messages, and finally closure. I don't want to look at the user agent part yet. I want to look at the SMTP part. So the SMTP part is what happens between these two mail servers. And where's the interaction part? Here it is. So the sender, so the client connects using TCP. And the first thing that actually happens in this message is the client makes the connection, but the server makes the first message in the protocol. It says essentially who it is. And the client says who it is with a hello message, and the server says, you know, this is kind of wasteful, and I'm surprised that they built this many round trips into this thing, especially given the latency of the internet at the time. But it does this three-way thing again, and then the client issues a mail command and says who the mail is coming from, and the server gets a chance to approve that sender if it's willing to accept it, and then the client lists a number of recipients, not just one, specific format, recipient 2, and gives the addresses, does a bunch of those, and then finally it says data, and the server says enter your mail, and you type in the mail. So you can do all this with an SMTP server just using a program like PuTTY, right? Just essentially connect to it and interact with it by typing, and you will see all these things happen. Problems. So this protocol is sort of the source of a lot of spam. It enables a lot of spam because look what you can do here. You can, as part of what you say in sending the mail, you can pretty much make up any old name that you want to. And although the server gets to approve it with this sender OK, notice that it hasn't actually really got anything to go on about approving this. You just made it up and there's no authentication and so on and so forth. So that's a problem. And then recipients, you can send to anybody. And because of the design of SMTP, it's willing to talk to any other SMTP server. You can send messages lying about who you are, and you can send them from anywhere in the internet to anywhere else. So this sort of led to spam getting started because it was so easy. These days we've made it harder to send spam, but it's still pretty easy. So if you telnet to a server on port 25 use PuTTY to do it, you can enter commands like that, and you can actually send email without actually using a user agent other than a interaction window. Okay. I don't know. These are just little piddly details that are not terribly significant as far as I'm concerned. So that's SMTP. Now there's also that's sort of how you push the mail out into the world. But there's also the question about what should the individual mail messages look like. And that's defined in an RFC number 822. And it says what goes into this space right here. Right? You are supposed to do certain things in that space after the server has said send your mail. Right? So what are you supposed to put there? You're supposed to put in a header which has to, from, subject, and date. And then you have the body. And that's essentially it, except that there are extensions to this RFC 822 that talk about how you include images and web pages and so on. That's called MIME. So, Multimedia Internet Mail Extensions. Okay? Why? That's what that is. That's why it's called MIME. And it allows you to include multiple parts inside the body of the message, and they can have different kinds. So remember, it all has to be standardized because I run certain kinds of mail clients and you run certain kinds of mail clients, and what I send has to be readable when it gets to you, and that happens through standards. Okay. Getting your mail. So like I said, my Thunderbird user agent, when it's sending mail, sends it with SMTP to the first server. But for getting mail, these days, we typically use protocols called POP and IMAP. POP stands for the Post Office Protocol, and IMAP stands for I don't know what. Internet Mail Access Protocol. There we go. Okay. So, in the early days, the reading of mail happened in a program that was running on this mail server. And so it was just a program that reached in and looked at files that the mail server had stored in that. But these days, we always go off and get our mail off of remote servers, and that's where Post Office Protocol and IMAP come in. So you guys all use internet mail, right? Nobody uses either one of these things. So the other possibility is that there's a program running on here that actually turns this into a website and looks into the files that delivers you your Gmail or Hotmail or something. So the only thing to say about POP and IMAP is that, again, we need some way to secure them. Yeah, question?
I think probably a lot of us have mail apps on our smartphones, which use...
Oh, yeah, smartphone. Actually, good point. The mail apps you use on your smartphone probably typically use IMAP, I would think. Post Office Protocol is older, even though it has a higher RFC number. There's an earlier version of it that does this. The problem with POP is that it's really oriented around you're going to download the messages from the mail server onto your one computer and read them there. And it gets sort of confused if you set it up to read mail from multiple computers. Because it's really oriented around what you're doing is you're downloading the mail. IMAP is oriented around you have the mail server as your storage for your email, and you have lots of clients that can look at that storage and look at it through a database, and on each client you can tell whether you've read the mail on other ones and so on and so forth. So it's more modern and nicer. So POP is another one of these plain text messages. It also has usernames and passwords passed through it. So you don't want to actually ever run POP these days on its default port without... doesn't say what that is. You would only want to run POP these days if it were secured by a TLS connection. We'll talk about TLS, Transport Layer Security, later when we talk about security, but it's a way essentially of taking this stream of data and encrypting it as it's being carried over the network and revealing password, you know, with wireless and everything. Everybody can see your password. That's not good. So you retrieve messages, you delete them, etc., etc. IMAP lets you actually build a folder structure on the server to store things in. Googleistas would say that's not the modern way of doing things. The modern way of doing things is to put tags on messages, and then they can show up in multiple logical folders at the same time easily, and to use search a lot. That's the Google view of things, but this is sort of a more classical files and folders way of looking at the world. Okay. Well, next time we're going to talk about the domain name server, domain name service, but before you go, I have a couple of questions. If you're still connected. Okay, so this is one of those cache computation things. Routed through a proxy cache server with an average response time and a hit rate of 40%, while accesses to the original web pages take 1 second, what is the average response time seen by clients? Point 0.1 seconds. 0.1 something or other. So how do you do it? I see some right answers and some wrong answers. So how do you do it? You take the 40% rate, which is 0.4 times the response time for that, which is 0.1, and add 0.6, the complement of the 0.4, times the response time in that case, and that equals, okay? So that's one I really want you to be able to do.
Where did the 0.6 come from?
The 0.6 is 1 minus 0.4. Let me actually write it out that way. That's a better way to say it. 1.0 minus 0.4. Yeah. Good. Thank you. All right. See how you're doing with the web stuff. Which of the following is true? GET requests cannot convey form data. POST requests convey form data in the URL part of the request. GET requests convey form data in the entity body part of the request. POST requests convey form data in the entity part of the request. Show you what you thought about that. In fact, it's the POST requests that convey form data in the entity body. GET conveys form data in the URL part. Okay? But you can do forms with either one. So take a look at that part of the chapter, and that will be fine. And oh, I had one other thing I wanted to show you. I'll have to do it next time because we're out of time. What I want to show you is what the headers in delivered mail messages look like and what they mean. Okay, that's kind of cool.